Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, May 10th, 2026, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of Three Women, Adams, Murray, and Barton.
The first girl we'll meet this morning is Abigail Smith, who was born in 1744 in the parsonage next to the Congregational Church in Weymouth, Massachusetts, where her father was the minister. Abigail had two sisters and a brother, but only her brother could go to school. In those days, girls were not allowed in most schools. Her mother taught her to read and write, and her father had a large library, so she read many books. She even managed to learn some French. Her parents encouraged her study, and her siblings and her church were especially important to her. In the middle 1700s, many congregational ministers were becoming more liberal in their theology, becoming Unitarians, and her father was among them, and so was her future husband. As an adult, Abigail became a member of the church in Quincy, Massachusetts, which became Unitarian in 1753. That generally means the minister had changed his theology and the congregation kind of followed along. She wrote, "I acknowledge myself a Unitarian, believing that the Father alone is the supreme God and that Jesus Christ derived from his being. There is not any reasoning which can convince me, contrary to my senses, that three is one or one is three." We'll hear more about Abigail later. Our second girl, Judith Sargent, was born in 1751 in Gloucester, Massachusetts, one of eight children who were all part of the Congregational Church in Gloucester. Her father was a ship owner, and the family was quite wealthy, but school was still not an option for a girl. However, her family did hire a private tutor for her brothers, who were preparing to go to Harvard, and Judith was allowed to sit in on their lessons. Her family also had a large library, and she read extensively. It bothered Judith a great deal that her brothers could get an education, and she wanted one so much, and some of her brothers didn't seem very interested. It seemed very unfair that the same opportunities were not available to her and her sisters. Like so many people in that era, their ministers' faith was evolving, which is a whole other story, and so was their families. Universalism was a much more open and logical faith. The idea that everyone is of value and that God loves each of us equally made sense to Judith. As a young adult, she wrote, "As a universalist, your heart cannot but dilate and your affections widen until the divine expansion encircles every form that is acted upon by the immortal spirit." Their church and their family all became universalists. And later in life, Judith married a universalist minister. And what of the childhood of Clara Barton? She was born several decades later in 1821 in North Oxford, Massachusetts. Her father was a captain in the local militia and a selectman of the local government. She learned to read and write from her parents, and then she attended the local public school. A lot had changed since the mid-1700s, including girls now being allowed to attend public school. Judith discovered an interest in nursing when her brother fell off a barn roof and injured himself. She apparently was the one who coddled him and tended him. She was only 10, but she's credited with nursing him back to health. The family was very active in the local Universalist church, and years later, she wrote, "I am a Universalist, a belief in which all who are privileged to possess it rejoice. I was born free and saved the pain of years of struggle and doubt." Each of these girls, Abigail, Judith, and Clara, had parents who encouraged their daughters to learn, and each had access to books. Each of their families was economically comfortable. Each grew up in Unitarian or Universalist families with religions that were more liberal than those of many other families. And as they grew into adulthood, the religions of their childhood shaped each of them, although their lives unfolded in quite different ways. Abigail Smith first. She met a man she would eventually marry when she was only 15. A young lawyer named John Adams visited her family, and he wrote in his journal that he found Abigail to be neither fond nor frank nor candid. A Apparently, he changed his opinion because a few years later, he began to court her. Abigail's parents were not happy about this. Her mother was appalled that her cultured daughter might actually marry some obscure country lawyer. But they did marry and settled in Braintree, Massachusetts, about 12 miles south of Boston, on a small farm that John Adams had inherited. 9 months later, they had their first child, the first of six, although only four would live to adulthood, three boys and one girl. Over the years, the family moved back and forth several times between Boston and Braintree as John's law practice expanded and as he became more involved in local and then national and eventually international politics. John Adams openly opposed the Stamp Act of 1765, and when several British soldiers were charged with murder after the Boston Massacre in 1770, he represented them in court, although that was a deeply unpopular stand. He won an acquittal, arguing that there was no proof that those particular individuals had fired the shots. Adams said, "Whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, we cannot alter facts and evidence. It is more important that innocence be protected than it is that guilt be punished." When John's cousin Sam Adams called for a Continental Congress in Philadelphia, John went. And in 1776, he was one of the authors of the Declaration of Independence. It was while he was away in Philadelphia that Abigail urged him in that letter, you've probably heard some of the words, that said, "Remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors were. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and we will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Over the years, John carried out diplomatic missions to France and the Dutch Republic, and later served as ambassador to Great Britain. And then he became vice president under George Washington and was elected president himself in 1797. It's quite a record for that obscure country lawyer that Abigail's mother looked on with such disdain. And what did Abigail do during those long years? She raised children, many, many children, first of all, often with her husband gone for extended periods. She wrote letters. Over 1,200 letters exist between John and Abigail. She taught children, her own and many others, including a local free black child who knocked on her door and asked if she'd teach him to read and write. She tended the family farm. She moved several times back and forth and back and forth between Braintree and various houses in Boston, depending on the needs of John's career. She was active in the Unitarian Church in Quincy, and her family attended regularly. Quincy is less than 4 miles from Braintree. Her son, John Quincy, traveled to France with his father as a teenager for an extended stay, and Abigail and the other children stayed home. Life was often lonely, and John was often very busy or gone. She writes, "I wish you would write me a letter at least half as long as I write you." After the children were grown, she did accompany her husband to France, which she liked a great deal, and to England, which she disliked intensely. Family life was not simple. Abigail's brother was an alcoholic, and unfortunately, two of her three sons. One side died of alcoholism while John was president. Over the years, she and John took in and raised several nieces and nephews and grandchildren, as alcoholic fathers became incapable of providing for them properly. And since John was away so frequently, almost all of the child rearing fell exclusively on her shoulders. Abigail missed John's inauguration because she was tending to her dying mother. Much of her energy went to caring for others, often shouldering that work alone while John was away for extended periods on government business. Abigail and John were the first couple to occupy the current White House, and it was far from grand. It was drafty and damp, and Washington itself was swampy and unpleasant, with hot, humid, mosquito-laden summers and very cold winters and nothing resembling central heating. She was a staunch supporter of her husband. She held elaborate weekly dinners in the White House. She made appearances on John's behalf, and she even planted favorable stories about him in the press. Abigail Adams was deeply knowledgeable about political issues, and she made her opinions known. In fact, her opponents began to refer to her a little sarcastically as Mrs. President. After John's presidency ended, the family returned to Braintree. She was delighted to reengage with the Quincy Unitarian Church and to settle back home. As their son John Quincy entered politics and became ambassador to Russia, she took on raising his children. While John Quincy's political career flourished, her beloved daughter died of breast cancer and her third son struggled with alcohol. In 1818, at the age of 73, Abigail Smith Adams died of typhoid. The bodies of Abigail and John Adams, and of her son John Quincy Adams and his wife, are all interred in the crypt of the Unitarian Church in Quincy. Abigail's life was a rich life of politics and letters, influence and love, but it was not an easy one. Judith Sargent's life was somewhat different. In 1769 and 18, Judith married John Stevens, a wealthy ship's captain who was also from Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is out on Cape Ann. Both her family and her husband's were moving from Congregationalism to Universalism. Judith strongly supported the war for independence, but it was not good for her personal life. The seas became unsafe, and her husband's shipping business suffered. Judith began writing, using a pseudonym, since women's writings were not generally accepted for publication. John Stevens sunk deeper and deeper into debt, and Judith's writings provided most of their income. John's financial state eventually became so dire that he fled to the West Indies to avoid debtor's prison, and he died there, leaving Judith a young widow. Meanwhile, a Universalist minister from England, John Murray, had been invited to Gloucester by Judith's family, and he settled there. In 1774, with support from the Sargent family, Murray started the first church in America that was built specifically as a Universalist church. Other churches had gradually become Universalist, but this was the first to be built specifically. And 7 years after her first husband's death, Judith married Reverend John Murray. The couple had two children, although only their daughters survived infancy. Judith Sargent Murray, and she always continued to use her middle name, her maiden name. She continued to write extensively on the importance of women's rights and economic independence, on federalism and on gender and class issues. One of her most famous essays had the amazing title, "Desultory Thoughts Upon the Utility of Encouraging a Degree of Self-Complacency, Especially in the Female Bosoms." Later, she and John moved to Boston after he accepted the pulpit at the First Universalist Church. Judith continued writing essays and poems, and she wrote several plays that were performed in Boston. Judith Sargent Murray even argued at one point that since women's bodies were usually weaker than men's, probably their minds were stronger to balance things out. In 1803, she and a cousin decided to put their beliefs in the importance of education for girls into practice, and they started a female academy near Boston. She worked for the education of all children, mentoring and even housing many nieces and nephews who were attending nearby schools. And like Abigail Adams, Judith Sargent Murray was a prolific letter writer. Over 2,000 of her letters exist to a wide range of family and friends and public figures. In 1809, John was paralyzed by a stroke, and Judith became his primary caregiver until his death 6 years later. After his death, she moved to Mississippi to live with her daughter and son-in-law, and she died there in 1820. And the third girl, Clara Barton, her parents decided that she should become a school teacher when she was 15. They felt she was too shy, and teaching school would help her get over that. She discovered that she really liked teaching and she wanted more training. So she enrolled in the Clinton Liberal Institute, which had been founded by Universalists. It's worth mentioning that there were over 20 schools of various kinds, schools and colleges started by the Universalists, and all but one admitted women from the beginning. And several of them used the same curriculum for males and females. While Clara was there, she learned that there were no public schools in New Jersey at all at that time. So she contracted with the city of Bordentown to open a school, the first free school in the state. Within a year, she had over 600 students, and the school was so successful that the town raised money to build a school building. But when the town decided they needed a principal for the school, they hired a man, declaring that it was unfitting for the head of such a large institution to be a woman. Clara was demoted to female assistant, and she soon resigned. At the age of 33, she moved to Washington, D.C. to take a job as a clerk in the U.S. Patent Office, the first woman hired for that position, and at the same salary as a man. The male employees were not happy to have to work with a woman, though, and they made life pretty miserable for her. Finally, after 3 years, Clara Barton was reassigned to become a copyist, a much lesser position with less pay, and eventually she resigned. In 1861, when the Civil War broke out, Barton encountered a group of wounded soldiers traveling through Washington. And she remembered the nursing skills she learned as a child when she cared for her brother. She began gathering supplies for the soldiers, using her living quarters to store clothes and food and medicines. And she asked Universalist churches for help in gathering materials. Over time, she established clinics and field hospitals, working on the front line of several battles and in prison camps. Supplies were often short. It's recorded that at Antietam, she used corn husks after she ran out of bandages. Barton would help any soldier in need, whether Union or Confederate. It's part of her Universalist beliefs, and not everyone appreciated that idea that all were worthy of care. In 1864, Clara Barton was appointed by a Union general to be the lady in charge of a field hospital. One of her more harrowing experiences happened there when a bullet went through the sleeve of her dress without hurting her and lodged in a soldier that she was treating and killed him. After the war ended, Barton learned that there were thousands of unanswered letters from families seeking to learn what had happened to missing soldiers. And after petitioning President Lincoln, she was allowed to begin efforts to find and identify remains and to notify families. She opened the Office of Missing Soldiers in Washington, D.C., which eventually identified over 22,000 men. And then she worked to identify over 13,000 who had died at Andersonville Prison and let their families know. She began to speak widely about her war experiences. She continued her work of locating and identifying the dead, and she became so exhausted that her doctor ordered her to take a sustained break. So she did. She went to Geneva, Switzerland, where she discovered the International Red Cross. She was tremendously impressed with their work, and she volunteered her services in the Franco-Prussian War. When Barton returned to the U.S. in 1873, she began a crusade to establish an American branch of the Red Cross. She met with President Hayes, who assured her that after the horror of the Civil War, the U.S. would never again enter any war, and so that organization wasn't needed here. But she didn't give up. When Chester Arthur became president, she persuaded him that the organization could be of help in natural disasters as well as war. And he agreed to support her. Within the next few years, the American Red Cross provided assistance in the aftermath of floods in Ohio, a famine in Texas, an outbreak of yellow fever in Florida, and other situations. Barton helped to open a branch of the Red Cross in Turkey. And in her 70s, she led a Red Cross expedition to Armenia and another to Cuba. Unfortunately, her leadership meant resistance at home. The trend was toward a more structured form of leadership, and her unorthodox, hands-on style had become outdated. And of course, there was the problem of a woman having so much power or influence. She retired under considerable pressure and lived until the age of 90 when she died of pneumonia. Barton never joined a church as an adult, although she attended one whenever she could. She wrote to a friend, "Your belief that I am a Universalist is correct. My father was a leader in the church in Oxford, Massachusetts, and I look for a time when the busy world will let me once more become a living part of its people, praising God in advance for the advance of the liberal faith among the religions of the world, which is largely due to the teachings of Universalism." Clara Barton Guilds were established in many Universalist churches to raise funds for charities. And with the help of these groups, Barton's home in North Oxford, Massachusetts, has become a museum, and the Clara Barton Camp for Diabetic Girls, which is still in operation. A few snippets from these three women in closing. Abigail Adams wrote, "I think that calm is not desirable in any situation in life. We were made for action and bustle. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them." Judith Sargent Murray observed, "What a censorious world says of me cannot offend or permanently hurt me. Was it to commend me, it would do no real service. I had rather be possessed of an unspotted conscience and the rational award of a serene mind than to have the world for admirers." And Clara Barton said, "I have an almost complete disregard of precedent and a faith in the possibility of something better. It irritates me to be told how things have always been done, and I defy the tyranny of precedent. I go for anything new that might improve upon the past." Three women, Abigail Adams, Judith Sargent Murray, and Clara Barton. Three lives of service despite considerable resistance and adversity, of making a mark as women, of speaking out as women even when others didn't want to listen. And now in our own country, 200 years later, a law is under consideration which could remove the votes and voices of millions of women. The right of women to control their own reproductive freedom is under attack, and the idea that all people should have access to health care has become a mockery. "Remember the ladies," Adams famously wrote. "These lives remind us that voices of resistance and empowerment need to continue to speak, and that the rights that our religious ancestors struggled for are not automatically given forever. As American citizens and as Unitarian Universalists, we give thanks for these lives, for our mothers, and for all they have given to us.